2012, February 23rd. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 34, Habitable Zones Around Other Stars. Well, so far we've learned about the properties of stars. Yesterday we had a very quick and brief and intense overview of the life cycles of stars. I obviously jumped over a lot of detail. That whole story of the life cycle of stars is a whole unit in Astro 162 where you get to dive into some of the cool stuff. But I wanted the big picture there to get an idea of the life cycle of stars is going to have some bearing on whether those are going to be hospitable places for life or not. The last thing you want is to have a planet around a star that only lives 2 million years and then blows up. It doesn't really give evolution or anything else much of a chance there. So you've got to kind of get a chance. This is life cycle of stars. The other piece, of course, is looking at the details of the solar neighborhood. What do our neighbors look like? What kind of stars we find around us? What's the census like? Those give us all the pieces, kind of where it is we're going to be looking and some of the criteria for narrowing down the search. Today we're going to put together the last piece we need before we actually start the search, and that is to revisit this idea of habitable zones around stars. Previously we talked about the habitable zone of the sun. That was our concern last week. But now I want to take this habitable zone idea and extend it outwards and generalize it to talk about all kinds of stars at all phases of their life. So today, we're going to consider the idea of habitable zones. So the main ideas we're going to be looking at today is that where we want to look for life, the best place to look is on where you expect there to be rocky planets, which are in the habitable zone, so they could potentially have stable liquid water on their surfaces. This is admittedly a fairly provincial way of looking at life, but we're pretty sure it works for our planet, so it's a good place to start. We're going to see that the size of a habitable zone around other stars has a number of systematics. Brighter stars will actually have wider habitable zones than fainter stars, but that habitable zone will be further away. That kind of makes sense, so we'll go through some of the numbers for that. Planets that get very close to the stars, if you go to a fainter star, the habitable zone should be narrower and closer in. But you can't only get so close before you get so close that you actually start running into the tidal field of this parent star. And if you get close enough, you will actually get tidally locked, so the planet always shows one face towards the sun, roasting the day side, freezing the night side. That probably has some implications for how habitable that habitable zone is this problem of tidal locking. The other problem is this low mass M stars that are the most common stars throughout the galaxy go through phases of their life, maybe most of them for a large fraction, where they are violently active. We often hear about solar flares upsetting communication. These have super flares. These are super flares that could in fact have A, make a bad day on the planet, or B, sterilize the planet. So this is a possible issue affecting habitability. You might be in the habitable zone, but you're also in a subatomic shooting gallery from the super flares on the stars. And finally, one of the other places in which we have to worry about the star habitability is the spectrum or temperature of the star. Hotter stars have a bluer spectrum that emits a lot of ultraviolet radiation. We know from our experience here on the Earth that UV radiation has a bad tendency to cause massive mutation, and at high enough levels is actually used for sterilization. If any of you have ever worked or knew people have worked in a biology lab working with pathogens, they have special tables with high intensity ultraviolet lights to sterilize samples. Well, stars can basically be a sterilizing lamp, even though it is technically a habitable zone. So you could end up with a planet that has stable liquid water, but the ultraviolet radiation environment is bad. That doesn't rule out the possibility of subsurface or oceanic life, but it does mean looking for life on the surface, plants and animals, is probably going to be difficult. So we're going to look in general at this idea of habitability, but now fold in all the things we've learned, the highlights of what we learned about the life cycle of stars. Well, just to recap a bit, the goal of this exercise is we want to find life. We want to find life on other worlds, and we want to know where to look. It's good to review what some of the criteria, the requirements we know are necessary for life as we understand it, at least life on planetary surfaces. First of all, we know we need a stable, long-lived source of energy. Now, before I used to just say source of energy, but now I'm going to qualify that. I want a stable, long-lived source of energy. It doesn't do good if your source of energy lasts for too short a time for life to get a foothold. So we need energy to fuel chemical reactions, and we need warmth from that source to provide an environment where liquid water is stable. We also need complex chemistry. We need elements heavier than hydrogen, helium, the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen elements, which when combined with hydrogen, sulfur, phosphorus, at least on Earth, are the fundamental molecules of life. So we need carbon. We know that's a requirement for life as we understand it. We need liquid water, and we need inorganics, because it's inorganic oxidation is one of the principal pieces of how we get energy. An inorganic compound might include phosphorus compounds, which we know are important for life on Earth, sulfur, and other compounds. Now, again, this is a somewhat provincial view of life. We're using the experience of and history of life on Earth to inform this. Later on, we're going to ask the question for a different time, can we relax any of these requirements and have lifelike non-equilibrium chemistry? So keep that one in the back of your mind that we're being provincial here because, well, we know it works here, so we might as well start with that. But are there other possibilities? The third thing we need for life is we need a place for life to emerge. It can't just emerge in interstellar space. And we certainly think, from the point of view of the emergence of life on Earth, is having liquid oceans or at least large amounts of stable liquid water is important. But also having land masses has certainly helped out for life on Earth. In other words, life needs a place to swim or a place to stand or maybe even a place to fly, but definitely you need liquid water. So this would rule out looking at things like gas giant planets and things like that, which really don't have surfaces. They're just inhospitable generally. This isn't to say that there aren't some chemical processes that might lead to life in a gas giant. We just don't know what they are, so it's kind of pointless to try to make criteria to look for something we don't know. It's bad enough looking for a needle in a haystack. We don't want to do the problem where we don't know what the hell a needle looks like. We won't ever know if we found it. And finally, we need a benign environmental condition. Now, I used to state this as ultraviolet radiation, but I now want to generalize the idea that what you want is a place where you have a stable, well-regulated climate. You don't want a place that's going to be going nuts on you every few years. I mean, the last thing you need is your environment going medieval on you every 100 years. That's really not going to help you out at all. Harmful ultraviolet radiation, or any kind of radiation, sets up the problem with the mutation environment. If your environment has got a lot of radiation, particle radiation from flares, UV radiation from stars, that's a mutagenic environment. Basically, you can't have stable evolution because you're basically zapping, you know, the molecules of heredity. We know that organics, the faint bonds that can carry heritable information, heredity, the molecules responsible for coding and transmitting heredity, as we understand it in all forms of life on Earth, are, relatively speaking, fragile. And the primary source of fragility is to radiation and ultraviolet radiation. Now, we do know of organisms, Deinococcus radiodurans, you know, Conan the bacterium can stand up to heavy radiation, but those are exceptions, not the rule. So, again, going back over a lot of what we talked about before, we need a source of energy, we need a place where complex chemistry can go. Both of those things really translate to liquid water. Seems to be one of the requirements for that. We need a place for life to emerge, and liquid water, again, is one of these ideal mediums to get started, although having land masses is nice because that gives us plant life, oxygen. There's lots of good stuff that can happen with that. And finally, we need benign environmental conditions. We don't want to live in an ultra-harsh environment that doesn't give life a chance. It probably drives evolution, but not the way you want it. So that's what we're going to be looking for. Now, where would we expect those conditions to arise? And again, we're going to be provincial in our looking because we kind of know the answer for the Earth. We think we're going to find those conditions on rocky planets that reside in the habitable zones of low-mass main-sequence stars. Okay. Some of these pieces here. Rocky planet means you have a surface to stand on, a place for water to pool, or a place for there to be land for plants or something else. They're going to be relatively large rocky planets, so they're big enough to hold onto an atmosphere, and they're going to be in the habitable zones of their parent stars, a place where stable liquid water can be for most of the lifetime or a good fraction of the lifetime of that star. And we're going to require low-mass main-sequence stars. because as we saw last time, only low-mass main sequence stars shine stably for very long periods of time. And by long periods of time, I mean a half a billion years or longer. So, main sequence stars are those stars that generate hydrogen energy by fusing hydrogen to helium in their cores. They live along this red band in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. So we're going to restrict ourselves to these stars. That's not too bad. 85% of stars live on this main sequence. So that means we've got a lot of places to look at this outset. It's only going to be the stars on the lower main part of the main sequence, with a maximum mass probably between 3 and 4 times the mass of the Sun. This boundary is a little bit fuzzy. Are going to live on the main sequence for more than a billion years. So that's going to be my criteria for long-lived. If you're more massive than that, upper A stars, O and B stars, they don't live long enough. They live a billion years or less, and so they're not going to live long enough to sort of meet our notion that life and evolution need time to go. So we need a stable source of heat for a long time. It's not just the energy. It's energy and the amount of time that it's available and that it is stable. It isn't wildly fluctuating or changing dramatically on you. So you have relatively stable environments. You also need to have some other time scales involved. We haven't talked about planet formation in this class, but planet formation actually seems to take time. It's a pretty rapid process, as we saw in our own solar system, but you don't want the star to live so short that it doesn't even have time for planets to coagulate. You also need time for life to emerge, but if all you get is to bacteria before the star becomes a giant or blows up, that doesn't help you with having visible surface life. And of course, we know that while evolution operates on our planet, it operates relatively slowly. So you don't just suddenly have fully formed complex multicellular animals. Took a while on the Earth to emerge. We only saw complex multicellular animal and plant forms emerge during the last 600 million years of the Earth's history. But the Earth is 4,600 million years old, 4.6 billion. So for the first 4 billion years of the Earth's history, there were not complex creatures, multicellular creatures, animals, and plants. So you got to give them some time. Now, we don't know that the 4 billion years for the Earth is the right number or not. There may have been lots of starts and stops in the past. Maybe on some places, evolution takes the right path, and fully, you know, up to multicellular life emerges in a billion years. So we don't know what the contingent history was on the Earth that meant, you know, on Earth it was 4 billion, but somewhere else it might be 1 billion. So we are kind of, you know, waving our hands and tapping our toes on this number here. But more than a billion years seems about right for the way we understand how fast these processes work. Rates of mutation, things like that. We do have some basis for making this. It's not a complete guess. So, what's the habitable zone? Habitable zone is the region around the star where we expect there to be liquid water on a planet's surface. So, we would like to find places that kind of look like that. That's our idea of a habitable place. If the planet's too close, meaning closer to the star than the inside of its habitable zone, you end up with too much solar heating, and on an Earth-like planet that leads to a runaway greenhouse effect that leads to superheating the atmosphere and vaporizing all your water. Kind of ruins your day all the way around. It's too hot for decent organic chemistry, and you don't have any liquid water. That's what happened to Venus. Venus is about the right size to hang on to its atmosphere. It's in kind of the right place. The problem is it's just too close to the sun, and it never had a chance to get started. It went into a completely unstable atmosphere, as a way of looking at it. Or more to the point, actually, the atmosphere of Venus is stabilized just nicely, thank you, just not in anything that's habitable. If the planet goes too far away, there's too little solar radiation. Water vapor doesn't stay liquid. Water doesn't stay liquid. It freezes out. When it freezes out, you don't get liquid on the surface. You shut down a lot of these cycles of atmosphere regulation, and you get snowball world. So either you get heat death world or snowball world, too hot, too cold, or you're just right. It's a classic Goldilocks problem. And the zone where you're not too hot or not too cold is your habitable zone. Now, to remind you, this is the habitable zone around the sun today. Sun is a nice middle-aged star, about 4.6 billion years old, shines with a certain amount of luminosity, and I can set two boundaries on where the habitable zone occurs. The conservative boundary, I'll remind you, is between 0.95 and 1.4 astronomical units, which places the Earth kind of just comfortably inside the inner edge, but far away from the outer edge. Mars is just outside the outer edge, or just kisses the outer edge of the conservative habitable zone. Venus is entirely outside the habitable zone. It's inside, it's closer to the star, as is Mercury. Again, according with our experience in our solar system, Mercury and Venus are inhospitable. Mars has an atmosphere, but not much. It's for cold and frozen. Only the Earth is an abode of life and liquid water. A more optimistic way of stating the habitable zone is the light green band, which ranges from about 0.84 astronomical units out to 1.7. It gives a little bit more latitude on the inside for atmosphere regulation. If your atmosphere is not too heavy, you could probably still have liquid water a little bit closer to the sun. And on the outside, it gives a little bit more advantage to heavier atmospheres that have more possibility for greenhouse effect, keeping you above the freezing point of water. And so in that particular mode, again, the Earth is comfortably inside the optimistic habitable zone. Venus and Mercury are not. They're still going to be dead worlds in this regard, inhabitable, uninhabitable. Too many negatives in a row. But Mars is actually just inside the optimistic zone today. But because of its small size, it froze out. It wasn't able to hold onto its atmosphere. Its atmosphere is too light. The greenhouse effect can't keep it warm, and Mars froze out into a dry desert world. But in the optimistic habitable zone view, you could have an Earth-like or slightly larger than Earth planet. Bigger gravity can hold onto its atmosphere, kind of, you know, give a little bit of credit to the numbers. You could have a habitable planet, but it wouldn't be a Mars here. So there's arguments about how you set these things, but you'll notice it's a relatively narrow zone, and it only spans two planets in our solar system in the most optimistic formulation. So no one thinks it's tighter than the conservative, and no one's really willing to loosen it beyond the optimistic. So this brackets the range. So we define this zone around our sun, where you have stable liquid water on the surface of an Earth-like planet with a surface pressure of about one atmosphere. And then you can play the games. That's what the dark green band, the light green band is. The sort of shaded darker green band is where you relax the requirement of one atmosphere. You relax the requirement that it be exactly Earth size. And you get to play around a little bit. But again, it's a tight balance. We can take this idea for the sun, and we can play that same game for other stars. But to do that, I need to turn this into a formula. In fact, I'm going to turn it into a pair of formulae. The location of a star's habitable zone can be described in terms of an inner edge and an outer edge. And I've defined this in terms of the conservative habitable zone. But you can insert the optimistic 0.84 or 1.7 in here to these same formulae so that you can pose them the same way. And they depend, to a good approximation, remember, we're working with an Earth-like planet, a rocky planet with typical rocky planet properties. It goes like 0.95 AU times the square root of the luminosity of the star compared to the luminosity of the sun. And then the outer edge is 1.4 times that square root. So what this tells us is as the star's luminosity goes up relative to what our sun's luminosity is, let's throw in 100 solar luminosity star, because I can do the square root easy in my head, this becomes the square root of 100, so that's 10. So the inner edge of the habitable zone will be 9.5 AU for 100 L sun star and 140 AU for the outer edge for 100 L sun star. So as you get to a brighter and brighter stars, the habitable zone moves outward. The other thing it will do is, if you're paying attention to the numbers, it also gets a little bit wider. So let's give some examples. Let's actually go back to some concrete examples here. And now I'm going to pick particular stars. We'll start with our sun, which is a typical G-type star, and it's a middle-aged G star, so its luminosity is 1 L sun today. The size of the habitable zone is 0.95 to 1.4 AU, as advertised. Square root of 1 is 1 in all units. So as a consequence, there's the habitable zone and the conservative habitable zone today. If I picked an A star, for example, the bright star Sirius in the night sky, has a luminosity of 80 times the luminosity of the sun. That's going to move the habitable zone outward. I put 80 under that square root and run the numbers. and I end up with a conservative habitable zone between 8.5 and 12.5 astronomical units. In our solar system, this is out in the zone that encompasses the orbit of Saturn. Its orbit of Saturn is at 9.5 AUs. So the habitable zone would be as far from its star as Saturn, this A star, as Saturn is from ours. Let's go to the faint end. Let's pick a red dwarf. In fact, I picked Proxima Centauri as my example. It has a luminosity of 0.008 elson, 0.008 of a solar luminosity. I plug those numbers into the formula, and I get a habitable zone between 0.08 and 0.12 astronomical units. That is a habitable zone completely inside the orbit of Mercury in our own solar system. So this illustrates the process. Two pieces. As the star gets more luminous, the habitable zone moves outward. As your star gets fainter, the habitable zone moves inward. Kind of makes sense, right? If you light a small campfire, you've got to stand close to it until you feel warm and comfortable. Now make it one of those mega Texas A&M kind of bonfires, and you've got to stand way back before you're comfortable. Stand too close, you catch on fire. Stand too far away, you're too cold. So your comfort zone depends upon the size of the fire. Okay? If someone's lighting a candle, you're going to be right up next to it before you're warm. The second thing that happens is you'll notice in these numbers, the size, the physical width of the habitable zone changes a great deal. In our solar system, it ranges between 0.95 and 1.4 astronomical units. It's 0.45 AU wide. Around this A star, Sirius, it's now 4 astronomical units. So from 0.4 AU to 4 AU in this particular example. When I drop down to the M star, it's now 0.04 AU. Just happened to work out that way, the way I picked these example stars. So 0.04 astronomical units wide, 4 astronomical units wide, 0.45 astronomical units wide for the sun. So not only does the habitable zone move out, as it moves out, it gets broader. There's a larger volume of space in which you could have stable liquid water on the surface of a kind of Earth-like, Earth mass type composition planet. So that's what happens to the habitable zones and stars. A graphic shows this. Now I've put on representatives of A, F, G, K, and M stars. We're going to ignore the O and B stars because the O and B stars don't live long enough. So we're going to, and the A stars are kind of marginal for that. And what I've plotted in green is the inner and outer edges of the habitable zone, and I've plotted the distance in astronomical units in the horizontal axis. So again, as we saw before, for a G star like the Sun, the habitable zone, I put in the planets at their appropriate positions on the scale. Notice this is a logarithmic scale, so it's powers of 10. That's why everybody's crunched up here. We see that for the Sun, which has a nicely known solar system, the habitable zone is at Earth. For an M star, the habitable zone is way inside the orbit of Mercury. For an A star, the habitable zone is out around Jupiter and Saturn, just as illustrated. And you can look at the width of the band. It is slowly getting wider as you move outwards. I've got a homework problem which has you playing with some of these numbers on the current problem set that's out. So the habitable zone, as you go out, gets broader and further as the star gets brighter. And as you work your way in, it gets progressively narrower and closer to the star. And it has this kind of sort of general S shape here because of the way in which the luminosity scales like a high power of the mass of the star here. Remember, luminosity scales like the mass to the fourth power. So we get a very dramatic change in luminosity. So you get a sort of a long, slow growth, and then it gets very rapid as you get to the more massive stars. So that's the concept of a habitable zone now, abstracted out to general stars. Bigger and hotter the star, further its habitable zone, the broader it is. Smaller, fainter the star, the closer the habitable zone is to the star, and the narrower it is. You sort of shrink down the amount of space where you can put planets. But that's not the only thing that assesses habitability. All habitability is, by the definition of habitable zone, if you take an Earth-like planet with Earth-like composition and you put it in that place, you could have liquid, stable liquid water on its surface. That was our definition. But there's other factors that influence whether life can emerge. Just having liquid water is not the whole story. for example, if you get too close to your parent star, you risk becoming tidally locked. The tidal locking will give you an unstable climate, as it happens. Low-mass M stars, the ones that have, you know, there are lots and lots of them, and you have to get really close in, have very strong stellar flares, some of them called super flares. They're brighter than any solar flare we've seen. That could have a potentially negative impact on life. It could go so far as to even sterilize the surface. Excess ultraviolet radiation, as is the case for very massive, very blue, very hot stars, can also produce hazardous environments by producing either dangerous mutations or, if intense enough, actually sterilize the surface. It's no good having warm, wet, liquid water conditions if you're basically living in a UV sterilization bath. You're not going to get a foothold in life on those kinds of worlds. Similarly, if you're getting blasted every month and a half by high-energy particles, probably not a good place to be. So there's lots of things that can influence the habitability. Let's take a look at some of these in turn. Let's take a look at this one. This is one that was actually non-obvious for a while. If a small body is orbiting very close to a large parent body, its rotation becomes tidally locked to that body. The most obvious example of this that we all experience is our own moon, which is tidally locked to the Earth. The moon completes one rotation for one period of orbit around the Earth. That means the moon basically always keeps the same face towards the Earth. That's why there's a far side of the moon and a near side of the moon. As much as I love the classic Pink Floyd album, there is no dark side of the moon. It's either the side that always faces us or the side away from us. So the moon is always tidally locked around us. The tides, if it tried to rotate faster or slower, it would be pulled back by tidal forces. The Galilean moons of Jupiter are also a place where we see tidal locking synchronous with their orbits. Helps you keep the same face towards Jupiter, or try to. In these cases, the orbits are actually slightly elliptical, and the attempt to break free of that tidal locking leads to the tidal heating that we see. So here's an example about, you know, one of these tidal locking systems. We're going to look at the moon. The moon basically raises a body tide on the moon. Earth raises a body tide on the moon, and therefore a little red astronaut always keeps the same face. But there's more to this as well. The moon tidal distortion basically elongates the moon on a line towards the Earth. This is general towards any parent body. As a consequence, you get this constant squeezing and stretching. If the moon was trying to rotate through its bulge, it would be squeezed and stretched, and you get internal heating. That internal heating robs energy from the orbit, from the rotation, and basically slows the rotation down. So if I made the moon rotation faster than being perfectly in synchronization, I would be getting squeezed and pulled over time, eventually slowing me back down into synchronization. Similarly, if I'm moving too slowly, I actually will spin back up. There's an opposite process. So this really is a stable locking situation. Perturb it, you tweak it any way, either too fast or too slow a rotation, out of synchronization, the system will basically come back into synchronization. So it really is. You are locked there. Once you get into that, you can't get out very easily. And it all has to do with the exchange of energy between rotation and the squeezing and stretching that you get in the tidal system. That's a good way to describe it. So this tidal locking is very important. Now, what does tidal locking depend upon, and how long does it take to get into tidal locking? I've made it sound like it's really quick, but it actually takes some time. So, tidal locking timescale depends upon the size of the orbit, how far away the body is from the star, and the mass of the parent star. Now, this is a fairly complicated formula, but basic numbers here are important. It takes about 10 trillion years multiplied by the size of the orbit to the sixth power, and the mass of the star to the minus 2 power, or 1 over the square of the mass. Now, don't worry about how this formula works. What's important here in detail is the fact that it depends upon the distance to the sixth power. That means it's very, very sensitive to how close you are to your parent star. And it also increases as the mass goes down of the parent star. So in order to get the time scale to be short, okay, if you have a very small star, that takes you longer to lock. Kind of makes sense. Smaller stars have less gravity. But it's this distance to the sixth power that's important. So let's ask a question of this thing, formula. How far can a planet be from its parent star so that after 4.5 billion years of doing this kind of tidal dance back and forth, it just becomes locked after 4 billion years? So the first 4 billion years, it's free to rotate, but it slows down and eventually slows down, and at 4 billion years is when it locks in place. This allows us to define what we'll call a tidal locking radius. The tidal locking radius is 0.4 astronomical units multiplied by the mass cube root. So it's a very weak function of the mass. If you have a very large mass star, the locking radius will be far away. A very small mass star, the mass will be very close in. For our sun, the locking radius is 0.4 astronomical units. You'll notice that's awfully close to the orbit of Mercury. Mercury is approximately locked to the sun, but not perfectly. It's not 1-to-1. It's actually in a 3-to-2. It works in the direction that it completes 3 orbits for every 2 rotations. And that has to be because of the elliptical nature of Mercury's orbit. But if Mercury was on a circular orbit at its closest position to the sun, because Mercury is on a long ellipse, so it comes close to the sun and then has the furthest away, at that perihelion, the closest to the sun, if Mercury was, instead of being on an elliptical orbit, was in a circular orbit at its perihelion, it would be locked 1-to-1. It would be locked so that Mercury would always keep the same face to the sun all the time. But Venus is out a little further away, 0.78 astronomical units, the Earth is at 1. We're outside, beyond the tidal locking radius, and so we're free to turn at whatever rate is appropriate to how we formed. So the Earth has not become tidally locked to the sun. We're too far away from that. If there was a mystery planet that no one had discovered closer to the sun than Mercury, it would be tidally locked. So that's what happens in our solar system. We can ask the question, what happens? Where is this tidal locking radius for other stars? Remember that main sequence stars range from very low mass stars, a tenth of to the mass of the sun or less for a red giant, up to about kind of 3-4 solar masses for the most massive star we want to consider as living long enough to kind of allow life to get going. So we'll take this picture. We just saw this picture of the habitable zone as the green band, M, K, G, F, and A stars from low mass to high mass. There's the sun, and sure enough, just as I said, the dashed line here is that tidal locking radius, that 0.4 times the mass over mass to one-third, mass of sun to 1/3 power. So if you're inside, closer to the star than this dashed line, you will be tidally locked to your parent star. If you're outside, you're free to rotate however you want. Tidal locking is inefficient. Tidal locking is inefficient over the lifetime of the solar system, which I've defined to be 4.5 billion years at this point. So we see that right now, Mercury is inside the tidal locking radius, as I just described. But as we move outwards, the tidal locking radius moves out. As we move inwards, the tidal locking radius moves in slowly, but the habitable zone is contracting rapidly. And there reaches a point between kind of late K, early M stars, where the habitable zone is inside the tidal locking radius. So this makes for an interesting problem of habitability. If you're sort of a high mass, the high mass end of M stars all the way up through A, then your habitable zone is safely outside the tidal locking zone. And you can have more or less normal, stable day-night cycles, because you can rotate however you want. But if you're within a certain radius, the habitable zone and the tidal locking radius cross. And stars of below a certain mass have their tidal locking radius, have their habitable zones inside the tidal locking radius. So I might have a planet on, say, a nice low-mass M star. It's nice and Earth-sized. It's in its habitable zone. It has liquid water potential on its surface, but it's tidally locked. So one face always faces its star. That front face gets roasted. The backside doesn't get any sunlight. It freezes. That's not going to make for a stable climate. Right? One place is too hot, one place is too cold. Now, maybe you can have a quasi-stable climate just around the day-night terminator. So maybe you get a strip of life around that terminator, but then you have the hot zones and the cold zones down behind it on either side to the day side or the night side. But you're permanently locked with a permanent day side and a permanent night side. There really is a dark side of the planet because there's a part of that planet that will never see its parent star. It will be in perpetual darkness. Similarly, there is a sunlit side that never sees the night. So that may be a factor that plays into habitability. While there are lots and lots of M stars, and I can get fairly snug up to the very dim fires of an M star, that may be stopped from becoming likely habitable worlds because of this tidal locking effect. That may set a minimum mass below which habitability starts to become unlikely, or at least more difficult because of tidal locking. Any questions about that? It's kind of an abstract concept, so let's walk through this, see how this works. Now, even if you were to get around tidal locking, and even if we sort of gave a pass and said, well, maybe there's life on the terminator on these things, M stars have another problem. They make super flares. Some of these flares produce not only ultraviolet, but massive amounts of X-ray. They actually show up in X-ray telescopes. This type of radiation could be potentially sterilizing. So on one hand, this may be just bad. This may actually say that while the zone is habitable, you're tidally locking, and then you're basically facing this particle and X-ray and UV blast every couple months when a super flare goes off, especially if it goes off right at you. The other side of that, however, and people have argued that we shouldn't probably write these off entirely, because if they're far enough away out and the tidal locking is not in effect, remember that evolution is stimulated by rate of mutation. It's genetic mutations at the molecular level that are the drivers of natural selection. So if you introduce an environment with a large number of mutations, but not so large that you sterilize, you could accelerate evolution on those planets. So a counter-argument to the uninhabitability of a flare star might be that, yeah, if it's too extreme, then it's a sterilizing environment, game over. But if it's a higher radiation environment but not sterilizing, then it might in fact make a stimulus or even an accelerator of evolution on those worlds, as we understand natural selection as driven at the molecular level by genetic mutation. So the question about the habitability and the role of flare stars is somewhat ambiguous. Now, clearly, if you couple that with tidal locking, you got really challenging environments to work with. So it's not clear how that's going to work out. So that's one of the other factors that comes into play. So you've got tidal locking, flare stars for the M stars. The other factor, as I've mentioned before, is if your star is too hot, you get an awful lot of ultraviolet radiation, and we know UV radiation is a problem. So let's take a look at this by looking at, again, we've been sort of breaking this out into M stars, G stars, meaning the sun, and A stars, which are kind of at the high mass end of where we expect the star to live long enough to have enough time for evolution and life to get a foothold. For the M stars, they're very cool. Their surface temperatures are about 3,000 degrees Kelvin. In this one particular case, I picked one that's 2,500 Kelvin. Okay, close enough. It's kind of close enough. The visible spectrum is represented by the rainbow, and the white line is the spectrum emitted by that star. So this is just a broad spectrum. We're ignoring all the absorption lines. And you can see it actually, the star, the M star, produces most of its radiation in infrared wavelengths, not in ultraviolet. In fact, it has very little ultraviolet at all. A star like the sun has a temperature of 5,800 degrees Kelvin, and it peaks out kind of roughly in the middle of the visible spectrum, produces ultraviolet and infrared in roughly equal proportions, but it, you know, produces a fairly flat spectrum, which is why it appears kind of whitish yellow here, right? The M star is producing most of its radiation at red and infrared wavelengths. That's why it appears kind of reddish-orange. But it's when I go up to an A star. In this case, I've picked one that's 18,000 degrees Kelvin. At 18,000 degrees Kelvin, most of its radiation, the white curve is the spectrum of the star, is coming out in the ultraviolet. Very little of the light, some of it's in blue, but very little is in the red. That's why this star looks bluish. I've actually used a computer program that will take this spectrum and render it the way your eye would see it if you were orbiting that star. So here the problem is the massive amount of ultraviolet radiation. The problem with this is, remember that life on the Earth, think back to when we talked about the history of life on the Earth. Life did not get a foothold on the surface of the planet until after there was enough oxygen in the atmosphere that UV chemistry with oxygen led to the formation of an ozone layer. Ozone and oxygen combined are opaque to ultraviolet radiation. They form a kind of an atomic shield for ultraviolet radiation from our sun. But if you crank the ultraviolet radiation up too much, you can actually UV destroy even those molecules. And so you have a shield, but it's thoroughly overwhelmed by the ultraviolet radiation pouring in from the A star. Once the Earth formed an ozone layer and the UV radiation at the surface declined is when the first plants and then later animals were able to migrate to the land. They'd been living in the oceans for billions of years, but it was only when the UV radiation levels at the surface dropped because of the rise of oxygen in our atmosphere that the land became habitable. But if you go through a star that's very hot, the UV radiation thoroughly overwhelms it. The surface is always sterilized. You may be able to still have life, have marine life below oceans. That's probably likely. There are going to be some limits, however. One of those is that on the Earth, the UV radiation, even without an ozone layer, the depth of penetration into water is not too deep because most of the light is, you know, the UV radiation is relatively weak. As you crank the UV radiation up, you get greater depth of penetration into the water to where you pass between too much UV and not enough to do any harm. So you end up with a sterile depth at the top of your ocean. That presents certain kinds of challenges for especially mobile marine life because how do they stay out of the upper quasi-sterilized zone where the UV radiation is too harsh for them? They don't go all the way to the surface. They go partway to the surface, and or they're slightly buoyant. They go in the wrong place, and mutations. It's hard to know where to draw the lines, but this kind of suggests that if the star is too hot, your likelihood of being able to have detectable life is going down really fast. You sterilize its surface, and you may make marine life, mobile marine life, much more challenging. Life on those worlds may not get much beyond the greatest depths of the oceans where it's always dark. So you may end up with dark life. And that kind of puts them kind of in the same class as what we think life might be like if it arose on places like Europa or Enceladus, where I refer to it as dark or hidden life. It's not on the surface. It's deep below the surface. So if we're going to be looking for planets where I can detect the signs of life in their atmospheres or in their spectrum somehow, this really is, and I'm not hedging my bets by looking at these really bright stars to do that. So those are the factors that come into play. Whoops. Didn't know I had that. So how do we summarize this? We want to look now for places that are going to harbor life. We're going to now try to narrow our search down to what we're going to look for as possible abodes for life. Okay, if they're in these red zones here, they're giants or supergiants or white dwarfs, they do not provide a stable energy source. They're either way too dim to be useful and just cooling off, or there are these very, very short-lived periods where the stars are swelling up. They're producing too much energy. So we're not going to go looking at giants. We're not going to look at supergiants. And we're not going to go looking around white dwarfs. We might see the remnants of planetary systems around them, but they're probably not places where life is going to occur because the solar radiation is unstable. So the idea of being a steady lifetime works. We want to exclude short-lived stars and stars that produce too much ultraviolet radiation. We need a little bit, you know, you need a little bit of mutation to kind of help things along genetically, but too much of a good thing sterilizes you. So we're going to be getting rid of the very most massive stars, the O and B stars, and we're probably going to be digging down into the A stars. Even though the A stars may live long enough, 500 million to a billion years, and have good reasonable habitable zones, they may have too much UV radiation. So the bottom of this boundary is kind of fuzzy. The other place where we might be nervous is at the very low mass end. This effect of tidal locking kicks into play so that the habitable zone is inside the tidal locking radius. And we end up with these weird worlds with all day on one side, all night on the other, all the time. That may set up an unstable climate, and therefore be an unstable place for life to emerge. But again, we don't quite know where to draw that line. We don't know where, you know, remember, evolution proceeds forwards when the environments are challenging. How challenging is too challenging? We only got one example, and we don't know how to draw that line. Similarly, we have a problem with strong flaring down here, which may make for a hostile radiation environment. Sounds like it's limiting, but that gives us a zone to search. We would search for F stars, G and K, and the upper end of the M sequence. So we would look at the more massive of the red dwarfs, K stars, G stars like our sun, and slightly hotter stars, the so-called F stars. That's a lot of places to go looking. And that, in fact, is where we've begun our search. And tomorrow, what we will describe is what are the search methods that we've used to find planets and how successful have we been. And on Monday, we'll talk about the properties of those planets. The bottom line is 760 planets and counting as of February 14th. See you all tomorrow.